Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the origins of the European refugee crisis and go to Turkey to speak with Antonia Rados, an award-winning veteran Middle East correspondent and crisis reporter for the German television network RTL, where since 2009 she has been the chief foreign correspondent. We'll discuss how much Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon have borne the brunt of the Syrian refugee crisis so far, and Turkey's plans to set up safe zones inside of Syria to deal with the crisis at its source. Then we'll go to Vienna, Austria, to speak with Christian Schuller, a reporter and correspondent currently based in Austria for the Austrian TV network ORF, who for the last 5 years reported from Turkey and Iran for ORF. We will discuss the shocking discovery of 71 bodies inside a truck abandoned by the highway near to a palace where European leaders were meeting to try to develop a EU policy to deal with the refugee crisis. We'll also look into the growing pressures from the right that Eastern European countries, in particular Hungary, are feeling as Germany prepares to take in over 800,000 asylum seekers this year. Then finally, we will speak with Lawrence Lessig, a possible candidate in the Democratic primary, now considering a run for President of the United States, a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic. We will discuss his article at the Huffington Post on dumbing down the democratic debate and why we can't govern ourselves effectively and what change would make effective governing possible. And joining us now from Turkey is Antonia Rados, who's a veteran Middle East correspondent based in Turkey for the German television network RTL. An award-winning journalist and crisis reporter, she has since 2009 been the chief foreign correspondent for RTL. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonia Rados.
Thank you.
And so far, Turkey has had an open-door policy for Syrian refugees. It's currently hosting, over 2 million, which is about 45% of all refugees from the country. And, of course, Jordan is also overburdened with refugees, as is Lebanon, that is having its own crisis of governance. Can we put it in perspective, given how much angst is going on in Europe about the refugee crisis, but the real countries that are bearing the brunt of it are Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, are they not?
Yes, they do. They do. And they do since 2011. Remember, this was the beginning of the revolt of the Syrian, mainly young people, against the regime of President Assad. Syria has become very bloody, and so many people have fled here to Turkey and to Jordan and to Lebanon. Now, you have not to forget that they have been here for about 4 years. And there have been some dramatic changes going on, which Europeans and probably also the world has not been paying attention to much. First of all, after 4 years, a lot of people are very tired of being refugees. They have lost hope of going back to Syria because the war is going on, but also because ISIS has become stronger. So they do not see any immediate solution in the crisis in Syria. But at the same time, there has been a dramatic decrease of money in Turkey, Lebanon, and in Jordan since 2015. I talked in the last days to International AIDS Organization, and they say that they have only 25% of the budget they would actually need in Turkey and in other countries to support this mass of refugees. So a lot of people now in Turkey, about 100,000 people alone in Turkey, in the last months have not gotten any money anymore, no food anymore. These are people who are parents. They think about the future of their children. And some of them decide to leave to Europe because they do not see any perspective anymore in Turkey and in the other countries.
And Turkey spent over $5 billion so far on humanitarian aid, I understand, for Syrian refugees. So what is this money that should be in the pipeline that's not? Where should it be coming from?
Well, it should become, especially for the UN and other big organizations from the international community, the United States, Germany, Japan. Some Arab countries are also contributing. And if you ask the officials of the organizations, they tell you all the same thing. the world has become very unstable. The Ebola crisis in Africa, the South Sudan crisis has erupted again. So all this money is now also going to South Sudan and to Africa, and therefore the Syrian crisis gets less and less money. But for the people living here, who mostly depend on the donors' money, this is a tragedy which has been going on in the last months. And a lot of people, I think, have decided to leave for Europe because the money is lacking here. They feel abandoned by the international community. I was just meeting a couple of hours ago a young group of students, Syrian refugees here in Turkey, and they all say the same. They say Europe and the West has abandoned us from the beginning politically. Now you cannot agree on that. This is a possibility. And they say, and now we even don't have the possibility to build up a future for our children here because the schools are closing and things like that. A very delicate and I think also dangerous situation, because this masses of refugees will probably all one day or another try to find another opportunity in Europe or somewhere else.
And again, I'm speaking with Antonia Rados, who joins us from Turkey. She's a veteran Middle East correspondent for the German television network RTL and an award-winning journalist and crisis reporter. She has since 2009 been the chief correspondent for RTL. So what's the logic then of the Europeans and as well as that the United States not stepping up to the plate here, particularly in the case of the Europeans, who are now faced with a refugee crisis? Wouldn't it make more sense for them to donate money so that people could live near Syria and perhaps return there soon?
Yes, this is right. And you ask yourself why the European Union, especially, you know, quite powerful and a very rich organization, has not been stepping up. People here in Turkey have said in the last months already that the situation is becoming very difficult and delicate. But we should not forget the political context of all that. That means there is not only a problem in Syria in the Middle East, there's a problem in Yemen, there's a problem in Libya, quite a big problem also, as you mentioned already, in Lebanon. More and more countries are falling apart and are becoming what we call failed states. So the European Union is not ready, especially not Germany, to intervene too much politically and too much militarily. That means not at all. So everybody's watching this increasing chaos and anarchy which you have in the Middle East, and nobody really has a good solution. Everybody knows stopping the flow of refugees is not enough. Taking them to Europe is not enough, because the situation in the Middle East and in part of Africa, as you know, is falling apart and needs a political solution.
Well, to some extent, surely you can make a case that the United States bears some responsibility, because a lot of these refugees are not just Syrians, they're Iraqis and Afghans, and the U.S., in effect, in invading Iraq and Afghanistan, broke these countries, and they certainly haven't fixed them. Is there a sense in Turkey that the U.S. should be also stepping up, since they bear some moral responsibility for unraveling the Middle East?
Well, you know, if you talk to individual Syrians, there is a general feeling that the West has abandoned this region and the people of this region. And don't forget, we're talking about a very young region. We are 2/3 of the population in the Middle East are under 30. So these are people who have a future in front of them, and they are looking for a future. The American influence in the Middle East is seen in general views, I would say, as quite negative, especially the Iraq war, the Afghan war, also the policy of President Obama, not really to pursue, let's say, a political solution in Syria. That means Iraq and Afghanistan, you're right, is seen as a legacy of the Bush administration, beginning of a chaos. A state like Iraq has been dismantled. Nothing has been built instead of that. But the Syrian crisis is considered also a crisis where President Obama was not extremely successful, because you remember he talked about the red line And then 2014, nothing happened when a lot of Syrians saw that the Americans would intervene, help them against the Assad regime using chemical weapons. 2 days ago, here, very close to the border, apparently now the Islamic State has been using chemical weapons against civil population. Doctors were talking about this here. So it means that in general, it's very difficult to distinguish between Europeans and Americans, because in the eyes of the people here, they feel abandoned by everybody who is in the West, and they feel abandoned also by the rich world, because now they say, you haven't done anything, you haven't had any solutions, we have supported dictators for a long time, you have done a lot of business, but in the end, we are now the ones who are paying the price of all that.
And in terms of Turkey and its obviously somewhat megalomaniacal, if not egotistical, President Erdogan, he got a severe rebuke from the recent elections, largely from the Kurdish and the Liberal Party. And recently he has obviously tried to, he wants to try again to get the absolute power that he was seeking, in a very cynical move where he proclaimed to the West that we're going to go after the Islamic State, but at the same time go after the Kurds, clearly to improve his electoral chances. There's nothing like a little war to get votes. I'm not sure whether that's backfiring on him, but where does it stand in terms of the idea that Turkey has often suggested that it would like to set up safe zones inside of Syria for the refugees?
Well, you know, you're right, because Erdogan is a very polarizing figure. There are people who adore him in Turkey, and there are people who hate him deeply. So it is a figure who is not very popular, of course, with groups like the secular women, because he is a member of an Islamic movement similar to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and therefore he is hated by part of the population. But others really love him. And what you have to say also, two things about Erdogan. First of all, even the international organizations will tell you that he is the only one who has stepped in to help the Syrian refugees with food and money when all the other donors and all the other countries cut out. So in Turkey, the people are relatively well off because the government has established a lot of good camps and is supporting them more than in other countries. And I think the other thing is he has a certain popularity in the Arab world because, rightly or wrongly, he has always stepped up in the last years against Israel and fought for the Palestinians and Arab people, as you can imagine, or Arab young people, think this is a very good idea. His idea of a safe haven was, if you think in the very beginning, he had this idea of the crisis, and he said we have to create this zone for the refugees. I think it was not such a bad idea. Probably a lot of lives, 300,000 people have been killed until now, especially by the Assad regime. This was not such a big idea, but he needed the support of the West, especially America. And as we know, a war-tired America didn't want to come and intervene militarily in a certain sense to make a no-fly zone in northern Turkey again. So Erdogan has been, to repeat that, a very polarizing figure, an authoritarian leader who, as you said, lost the election, is fighting for re-elections now, who will be on the 1st of November. But on the other side, he is somebody who is quite liked in the Arab world and with young people who are religious, also Syrian people. And let me say, I think one thing which an analyst said about Erdogan, you know, the problem of Erdogan is not that he is too Islamic. The problem of Erdogan is that he's too Turkish. He is, has a loud voice. He likes to talk like a dictator. But he's not talking to the Americans in the West. He's talking to the population here. And many think, at least, he is a leader in comparison to others.
Well, but it does seem that he's opened a can of worms by attacking the PKK and the Kurds. And after all, as far as the United States is concerned, the only people that are fighting the Islamic State are the Kurds. So far, it would seem that to some extent, Erdogan turned a blind eye to the Islamic State. He had an underground railroad for the diaspora of the fighters that joined the Islamic State from Europe. So is there a sense in Turkey that Erdogan is responsible and is suffering some blowback from the Islamic State?
But I wouldn't say so. I think you're completely right that for many years, his government has turned a black eye towards the Islamic States. The Turks would say the border crossings are very, very difficult to control. We know also that, you know, the core of the Islamic State is not coming from Turkey. Let's remember it's coming from Iraq. And in Iraq, it was the American invasion which created this chaos in Fallujah and Ramadi. And, you know, al-Baghdadi is not a Syrian guy who came into the country by Turkey. He is an Iraqi, and the leadership is from Iraq. So, of course, the chaos which we had in Syria during the war has helped the Islamic State. The Turkish government has turned a blind eye. The Americans have not really intervened quickly when the Islamic State came up. And a lot of Arab countries did not do enough. The fact is that probably the whole solution for the Islamic State is not only a military solution, but a political solution. I would say you could not blame only Erdogan for that. But what Erdogan apparently is doing in the moment, which Kurdish sources will tell you, is he's fighting against the Kurds, the PKK, as a kind of revenge because they stole his elections in June. He wants them to punish for that, and he wants to weaken them, to divide them, and to win the next election on the 1st of November. This is one thing. And therefore, he's very tough on the Kurds now. But many people here question, or some people, let's say, question also why he's letting all the Syrian Sunni people coming into Turkey, why does he want a security zone? And there are small suspicions that he is trying to create a bigger Islamic community by integrating the Syrian Sunni into Turkey and maybe also taking part of Syria, which is a country which is falling apart. So I think the really important thing is to keep in your head that the Middle East is falling apart. The borders we know until now from Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, all these countries do not exist anymore in the way we think they do. And therefore, people like Erdogan, who is a smart politician, is probably thinking of the future and asking himself, what part can I take out of Syria?
Well, I very much appreciate you joining us here today, Antonio Rodas. I thank you.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Antonia Rodas from Turkey, where she is a veteran Middle East correspondent for the German television network RTL, an award-winning journalist and crisis reporter. She has, since 2009, been the chief foreign correspondent for RTL. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back going to Vienna, Austria to talk about the refugee crisis and the recent grisly discovery of 71 bodies inside a truck abandoned by the highway.
جيتني بجوز عيونه خالص مار الحنطاوي Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Vienna, Austria, is Christian Schuller, who is a reporter and correspondent currently based in Austria, who for the last 5 years reported from Turkey and Iran for the Austrian TV network ORF. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christian Schuller.
Hello.
And first of all, let's go back to the incident that took place last week, where a refrigerated truck from a chicken company in Slovakia, sold obviously to smugglers, was abandoned by the side of the road. 71 bodies were later discovered. And all this happened very close to a palace in Austria, where the European leaders were meeting to try and get their hands around the refugee crisis. So deeply ironic, but I take it, as somebody that's lived in Austria and has been there recently, Christian, I've spoken to people in Austria who've said that they've seen this coming, that more and more people are on the streets, refugees, more and more people are in the parks. This is not a surprise to anybody.
Yes, of course, it was not a surprise, but still this incident sent shockwaves through Austrian society, and not only in Austria, but in all of Europe. This picture was just too hard to stomach. These people in a truck that was in a chicken truck coming to Austria, probably already as dead bodies, because probably they have already died in Hungary. Somebody just left this truck on the road and disappeared. And 2 days later, people found this car already smelling death, and then opening it, and nobody could believe what they found in this car, because there were children, there were adults. And I think this picture was so far the strongest concrete impression that Austrians could get from this crisis. And it also triggered a lot of response. There will be demonstrations tomorrow, for instance, on the streets. People will try to commemorate those 71 dead people and asking the government to do something to save lives and to treat those refugees in a more humane way.
And since then, there's another incident where a van was discovered with Syrian children close to death from dehydration. They were taken to a hospital, treated, and then suddenly the entire family disappeared across the German border.
Yes, I mean, this we will see those incidents, I think, much more of them in the coming months. Germany is expecting around 800,000 refugees for the next month. And already some German and Austrian towns are completely cramped with refugees. Small border towns like Passau in Germany, or also like Eisenstadt in the south of Austria, close to the Hungarian border. Yeah, you can see refugees all over the place, and the public opinion in our countries is kind of split. There's a lot of empathy and a lot of solidarity with refugees. And on the other hand, there is also the right wing, the political right wing, asking for much tougher measures and sending away and sending back refugees. So the governments in Central Europe are kind of between two fires.
Well, at this meeting of European leaders, which ironically took place very near to where this grisly scene was discovered with the 71 bodies inside this refrigeration truck without any ventilation, Angela Merkel made, I thought, a very morally upstanding speech about the moral responsibility that wealthy European countries have to these desperate people fleeing the war zones of the Middle East. And she was booed, was she not?
Yes, but on the other hand, what we can see clearly is that most of the European governments are desperate about what kind of answer they could give to this situation. Technically, of course, it would not be a problem to accommodate even 800,000 or 1 million refugees for the next month. This is not a technical problem to accommodate them in our country. On the other hand, all this happens in a climate where the right-wing parties have pushed very hard anti-immigration laws and, and, a general feeling against immigrants, against foreigners. So and most of the governments in Hungary, in Austria, in Germany, and so on, are kind of very responsive to these right wing parties, fearing that they will lose votes to them if they are seen as too soft on refugees. Because of course the logic is that the better the refugees are treated in our countries, the more will come. So the right-wing parties say, therefore, we should create hell for them, while, let's say, the majority of the population, I would say, thinks that this is a humanitarian crisis where we have to show solidarity and where we have to help and support those people. Another question is what to do against this kind of traffic under those circumstances, people being sent with this kind of cars and under terrible circumstances. So there is always the one answer, which is police. We have to fight against those gangs of smugglers. We have to find them. We have to arrest them. But obviously, this will not solve the problem.
And clearly there is a need for some kind of coordinated European response. And there's efforts along those lines to set up some kind of registry for new arrivals and a common EU list of safe countries of origins. How much do you think the political authorities can get their act together before they're completely overwhelmed by this ongoing crisis? And there is a split, I think. You mentioned the right-wing pressure that governments are under. It does seem that the British and the French are not being particularly compassionate, where the Germans and the Austrians are. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I would say it's more complicated than that, because there's also the Eastern European countries, also members of the European Union, who have a rather tough line, like Poland, for instance, like Hungary, also having their arguments, because Poland, for instance, says that they have to prepare for a large group of Ukrainian refugees who will probably come to Poland, who are already coming, and therefore Poles say we have no space for Syrian refugees because we have already another crisis just behind our door. And so there are different interests of these European countries, which makes it very difficult to find, for instance, a common formula for the repartition of those refugees. The other thing you mentioned is the list of safe countries where refugees could be sent back. So there is some tendency now in the European Union to put more and more countries on this list of safe countries, like, for instance, Albania, probably in the coming months. But if you look closely at those countries, they are not safe at all. If you look at their system of human rights, the record of human rights and civil rights, the way the system is working there. So if you put more and more people, countries on this list of safe countries, this will not solve the problem either, because those are not really safe places. This is just a way Europeans try to deceive themselves.
And of course, the Hungarian government is building a razor wire fence on its border with Serbia. Mm-hmm. Curious enough, though, a lot of these Eastern European countries already have a kind of emigration problem in the sense they have a brain drain to other European countries, particularly, say, the UK, where a third of Portugal's qualified nurses have migrated, 20% of the Czech Republic's medical graduates have left, and 500 doctors are leaving Bulgaria every year. So they have their own problems. But how do you balance this against, for example, you know, a very poor country like Jordan is overwhelmed. They have millions of refugees from Syria. I believe in Turkey there are substantial numbers, even though that's the origin.
Especially if you mention the case of Turkey. I mean, Turkey received 2 million refugees at least during the last years, most of them from Syria, but also some from Iraq. Turkey has asked the European Union to help them to handle this situation. And at that time, that was just 1 year ago or half a year ago, when Europeans still did not see this huge wave of refugees coming, So they showed a very cold shoulder to Turkey. But of course, this is one key of the problem, because many of those refugees who come to Europe now have been in Turkey, but in Turkey, the situation also becomes unbearable for many of those refugees, so they don't want to stay there, and they move further.
So when you say, Christian Schuller, that Germany is expected to receive 800,000 asylum seekers, and that, of course, you have to assume that there'll be more people than that, because the situation is burgeoning. What is the magnet? Why is Germany where the destination that people go, leave Turkey, cross into Greece, then they go to the Macedonia, where we've seen some ugly scenes on the border with border guards beating up these desperate people. Then they get into Hungary, where I believe there are hundreds stranded at a railway station with tickets to Germany, and they're not allowed on trains. So there doesn't seem to be any consistency here. But so there are two questions, the inconsistency, and then the other one is, why is Germany the magnet?
Well, I think Germany, in any case, is seen as the one country which offers the most opportunities for the future of those people. And I think everybody in the Near East or in Africa or any other place in the world would think about the future in such a situation. If he has to leave his home, where could you stay just and make a living and find jobs and also find maybe a living for your children? And I think that Germany is seen as the most stable country with the most stable economy and therefore offering opportunities, offering a future. That's the main reason, I think.
So what's your sense then of how your small country of Austria, with a population of 8.5 million, can handle this situation? Because I think we have to assume it's getting worse. It's not getting any better with the war in Syria, with no conclusion in sight, Iraq with no conclusion in sight, Afghanistan falling into chaos, Libya already in chaos. It seems to me that this is a problem that is going to get worse.
Yes, but I think that there are two sides of it. The practical, if you want, even pragmatic side of it, and the political side. Pragmatically, Austria could absorb much more refugees, taking into account Austria's economy and our situation, our standard of living. But of course, no Austrian government could really endure if there is a feeling in the population that Austria is taking too big a share of this refugee problem. So therefore, the Austrian government needs, even symbolically, solidarity from other governments and from other countries. And the Austrian government needs to tell its people that, okay, we have to do a big effort, but others are also sharing the burden. If that is not the case, then of course it will help the right-wingers in Austria also to take over like in Hungary.
And if this fence that the Hungarians are putting up, assuming that it works, because I understand that because this human smuggling is so lucrative and the smuggling rings are so callous and ruthless, and those that have been captured in connection to the 71 bodies found in the refrigerated chicken truck by the road in Austria, they're small fries, so it doesn't seem like anybody's going after the big guy. So is it possible that the gangs will find ways to get their people through the fences, or will the refugees take a more southern route around Hungary into Austria?
That's more probably is that they will find another route. And one route will be shut down, but there will be other possibilities. But also, we are just looking at the Syria crisis right now, because it's the most probably the most dangerous one in terms of refugees. But there could also be some change in the Syrian situation if the Turkish government succeeds in realizing one of its main plans, which would be to relocate Syrian refugees in Syria, in those newly created safe zones, because that's strategic plan of the Turkish government to create those safe zones in Syria to relocate the refugees in order to disrupt the pattern of Kurdish population on its border. So maybe Syria will not be the hotspot number one of refugees in 1 year or in 2 years. Nobody knows. But there are other places where people are coming from. And it's not only Syria. Of course, by numbers, Syrians are now the biggest group of refugees right now. But this can change in a few months, and there will be other waves from other places.
Well, just in closing, Christian Schuller, here in the United States, I think it's fair to make the argument that we bear some responsibility for the chaos in the Middle East, particularly the Iraq War, that destroyed a functioning country, even though, of course, it was led by a hideous dictator, and nobody could pretend that Afghanistan under the Taliban was particularly pleasant. But nevertheless, we here in the United States can't claim that we've done anything to improve the lives for Afghans and Iraqis. In fact, I think we can be held responsible for a lot of the refugees fleeing these broken countries.
Yes, I mean, that's the way it is, that's the way most Europeans would see it. But on the other hand, as I already said earlier, we can blame ourselves, Europeans, as we have turned a blind eye to the whole situation for such a long time. And nobody wanted to see it. Nobody wanted to deal with it. And now Europe is really paying the price for this.
Well, Christian Schuller, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Vienna, Austria.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Christian Schuller, who is a reporter and correspondent currently based in Vienna, Austria. He, for the last 5 years, reported from Turkey and Iran for the Austrian TV network ORF. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back with speaking with a possible new candidate for president in the Democratic primaries. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and founder of Root Strikers, an activist network opposed to corruption in government. He's the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic. He has an article at the Huffington Post on dumbing down the Democratic debate, and he is a possible candidate in the Democratic primary for president. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Lessig.
Great to be here, Ian. Thank you for having me.
So, Lawrence, when we say you're a possible candidate, I take it that you will decide by Labor Day, and at the moment you're essentially crowdfunding your campaign, and is that where we stand?
That's right. I'm trying to crowdfund $1 million by Labor Day. We're up at about $650 right now, and if we can get to the million, then I will run.
And does $1 million get you on the ballots?
$1 million gets the campaign going, mm-hmm. And once we get the campaign going, then we believe we can get the attention to be able to be in the debates, and if we're in the debates, then it's going to be it's going to change the way the campaign is seen, I think, and then we'll be on the ballots.
But I recall that it took millions and millions of dollars from Ross Perot to get on the ballot. The two parties have rigged the system, have they not? It's not easy for newcomers or outsiders crashing the party.
That's right. If I were running as an independent, it would create it would be very difficult to get on the ballot. But what I'm running is in the Democratic primary. And so if we raise $1 million, I'll enter the Democratic primary and be one of the candidates on the debate stage in the primaries leading in New Hampshire and in Iowa.
So turning to your article at the Huffington Post on dumbing down the Democratic debate, you make the point that everybody blames our corrupt political system, and of course everybody on the left in this country blames the Republicans. But to deal with the former, recently the New York Times told us that 400 families have given half the money that's been raised in the election cycle so far. So we're certainly not wrong in being disgusted with money in politics.
No, and I think we need to get a lot more concerned, a lot more upset, because the reality is something we know in the back of our heads. Nothing in our government can happen until we fix this corrupted system first, until we fix our democracy first. We've been running along pretending we can just elect Superman, and Superman can go down to Washington and wrestle the special interests to the ground. But Superman and Superwoman don't have magical powers in Krypton, and Washington is Krypton. And when they get there, the special interests have the power again and again to stop them from enacting the most important changes we've got to be able to fix. So climate change legislation will not happen in the United States until we change the way campaigns are funded. We can't take on Wall Street with new regulation that deals with the incredible instability they bring to our economy until we change the way campaigns are funded. Each of these important areas, what we've got to do first is to fix the democracy. And so my campaign would be a strategy, really a hack, to enable us to pass a referendum to demand this democracy be fixed. And then I would hand the presidency over to the next great president, who would have the opportunity to actually do something with a democracy that works.
So, in effect, this is an interregnum that you're talking about.
In principle, that's right. I mean, it wouldn't technically be. What I would be is elected president. And what I've said is I would be president until Congress passes what we're calling the Citizen Equality Act, which would be a fundamental reform to address this deep corruption. And then once Congress passed that statute, I'd step aside. So, in theory, it could be a very short period of time, especially if we build a sufficiently strong, really constitutional movement to demand this change. And my election would be the ratification of that demand, and that would create enormous pressure on Congress to actually do something about it.
And in your article at the Huffington Post, Lawrence Lessig, on dumbing down the Democratic debate, you respond to Thomas Mann, who, along with Norman Ornstein, wrote the very important book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. And as it happened, I spoke with Norm yesterday. He has a new article at The Atlantic on Donald Trump, and he's making the point that this year is really different, that Donald Trump is a very different candidate, clearly. He's not the clown and buffoon that he's dismissed at. He seems to be very effective. And clearly on the left, you've also got a very effective campaign going with Bernie Sanders. So I take it that you want to tap into this. It's not even a vein of discontent. It's a gushing artery of discontent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what's distinctive about what Donald Trump shows is, even though he's got, in my view, really horrible views about immigration, and he's got really horrible views or sensitivities about women, he has uttered a truth that all of us in our heart of hearts believe is true, and that is that these presidential candidates, and even more so members of Congress, are not independent actors in our political system. They are dependent on their funders. So when he says, look, if Jeb Bush takes $1 million to fund his super PAC from somebody, he's got to think about that person when Jeb Bush goes to make a decision that affects that person's interest. And that's true not just with one person, that's true with 100 people who are funding his $100 million super PAC. And it's true for congressmen all the time. So we have a Congress and a presidency where these representatives can't represent us because they first have to make sure they're representing their funders if they want to make sure they have the funding they need to get reelected, which all of them, of course, want to be reelected. So Donald Trump is calling it for what it is. And, you know, as much as I disagree with Donald Trump, you know, I think we have to get above the partisan bickering and identify things we agree about and identify them and move forward with them. And, you know, we've seen incredible progress on criminal justice reform when the right and the left says, look, enough is enough. These mass incarcerations are just ridiculous. And we need to do the same thing with corruption reform. We need to say, yeah, this is a completely corrupted system. And even though I disagree with you on a million things, I agree with you on this, and let's do something about it together.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and the founder of Root Strikers, an activist network opposed to corruption in government. He's the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic. He has an article at the Huffington Post on dumbing down the democratic debate. And he is a possible candidate in the Democratic primary for president. He will announce by Labor Day. And at the moment, he is crowdfunding his campaign and close to the ceiling that you've targeted, which is $1 million. And of course, in your article, you asked the question, why can't we govern ourselves effectively? And what change would make effective government possible? So can you give us a quick answer to the latter?
Yeah, so the clue is a very famous quote by one of America's most important political philosophers, actually corrupt political philosophers, Boss Tweed, who ran the Tammany Hall political machine in New York in the 19th century. And what Boss Tweed used to say is, I don't care who does the electing as long as I do the nominating. And that's exactly the system we set up for Congress right now, because the nomination of members to be candidates for Congress depends on them being able to raise money. The first primary is not a voting primary, it's a money primary or a green primary. And when they raise the money for that primary, they raise it from the tiniest fraction of the 1%. So that the people who fund the campaigns, the nominators, know that those candidates will be responsive to them, and that's all they care about. Because they know if they're responsive to their funders, they don't have to worry about what they do to be responsive to the people. So if we don't change that, we are not going to have a representative democracy. And if we don't get a representative democracy, we're not going to have a government that can actually address the problems that all of us think we need to address. So I don't care what your issue is, climate change, the debt, student debt, healthcare reform, Wall Street reform, doesn't matter. We've got to fix this corrupted inequality if we're going to have the capacity of a government to actually represent what the people want it to do.
But if you create a system, which we have created, of Congress people essentially becoming telemarketers, dialing for dollars all day and not doing the people's business, surely that's a system. If you base your system on money, he who has the most money wins. And this is a perfect system for an oligarchy, isn't it?
It's almost as if it's been designed for that. I think we kind of tripped into it. I don't think anybody really planned it, but that's certainly where we are. They sit subservient 30 to 70% of their time every day, these members of Congress, sitting there calling up, sucking up to people who have money, asking these people for their money, and understanding what they need to say to those people in order to get their money. Now, you can't, if you're human, do that for that amount of time and not be bent by that experience. And you're bent in a way that makes you responsive to these people who are doing you the favor of making it easy for you to get off the phone because the most miserable thing in the world has got to be calling people and asking for money. So this is a system that's almost designed. Now, you know, it's very familiar if you think about what's going on in Hong Kong right now. You know, in Hong Kong, there was a huge protest because the Chinese government said candidates will be nominated by 1,200 citizens in Hong Kong. And of course, Hong Kong, those 1,200 citizens weren't random. They were pro-Beijing business political elites. And what the protests were about was that's not democracy. You can't limit the nomination to this tiny fraction of unrepresentative few. Well, that's exactly what we have in the United States. Indeed, exactly the same proportion. 1,200 is about 0.02% of Hong Kong. If you look at the people who give even just the maximum to just one candidate, that's about 0.02% of America. We, in both cases, have handed over the nomination to a group that is not representative of the people, and therefore we've destroyed the very idea, the core idea of what a representative democracy should be.
But surely, Lawrence Lessig, there's nothing new about rich and powerful people wanting their political agents, their congressmen and senators, to be beholden to them, to be essentially hirelings, and therefore not to be particularly talented people, but loyalty being the more important qualification. And perhaps that explains why there is so, I mean, the field, particularly on the Republican side running now, is less than spectacular. And I must say that Donald Trump, in eviscerating this field rhetorically, as he does often, I think is being extremely effective. So what's your explanation for why we have such second-rate politicians? Is it purely that humiliating notion of having to dial for dollars all day?
Well, first, let's be clear. You're right. Money has always mattered, but it has not mattered this much in more than 100 years. You know, that statistic of 400 families funding half of the money in this political cycle so far is unprecedented, all the way back to the time of Teddy Roosevelt. So this is new. Now, I do think it has effect on the kind of candidates we've got, especially in Congress. You know, the life of being a congressman is miserable. You know, the idea of sitting there calling all the time for money, nothing gets done in Congress. Your whole conception of what a congressman is supposed to be has no connection to what, in fact, they get to do. And though there are many great leaders in Congress, I mean, I have enormous respect for the public servants who actually devote themselves in the way that they do to become public servants. It's no comparison to what it was, you know, even just 40 years ago or 50 years ago. There are not the same kind of people, because those kinds of people, those kinds of leaders look at that institution and say, why would I waste my time? Why should I waste my time? It's not the way I can use my talents in the best way possible, so I'm just not going to do it. So yes, I think it is weakened government, weakened the capacity of government to make sensible decisions. And it attracts, really the wrong kinds of people. When I first started talking about this issue, people tried to recruit me to run for Congress. And Joe Trippi, the guy who ran Dean's campaign, flew in, appeared at my doorstep, said, I will run your campaign. And he said, but you got to promise me, every day between now and the day you announce your retirement, you'll get on the phone and spend 2 to 4 hours calling people. And I said, Joe, no, I can email them. He said, no, you got to call them. You got to call them 2 to 4 hours every day. And I said, well, that's easy. You know, I can't do that. I just physically cannot do that. And he said, well, okay, then you can't be a candidate. But it made me think, who are the people who can do that? What kind of person is it that finds it a proper use of their time? Not to be calling people randomly. I'd be in favor of the system if it said, you know, call a random citizen in your district. But they're not calling random people. They're calling the tiniest fraction of the 1%. And that influence is a corrupting influence in our democracy, and we won't get anything done until we find a way to fix it. And that's the idea that I've put forward in this referendum presidency.
But, you know, Bernie Sanders is getting donations of the average amount is $30. So he's proving that there's an alternative, and you're getting crowdfunded over the internet. You're not dialing. You know, people have who can get online can donate to you and your effort. So there's evidence out there that there are alternatives. So why is it then that the Washington establishment, particularly the punditry, don't believe that reform is possible?
Well, I have enormous respect for Bernie Sanders. I think Bernie Sanders has been incredibly important incredibly important influence in this debate, and not just in this debate, ever since he went to Congress. But the important thing to remember is not whether he is supporting the right policies, which I think he, you know, is pretty close to supporting, but whether he's given us a plan for how he's going to get these reforms enacted first.
Bye.
So that, that's my son leaving. I'm sorry.
No worries. Go ahead.
So how is he going to get this enacted first so that all of the other amazing things that he's talking about are even credible as ideas? You know, I just fear this is going to be Obama 2.0, where Obama in the primary talked about this issue again and again and again and again, and then it disappeared, and when he got to Washington, he didn't raise the issue once. Now, Bernie Sanders says, well, that's because Obama told all of his supporters to go home. But that's not true. Obama built the biggest grassroots organization supporting a president in the history of the presidency. But the grassroots organization was not enough to take on the Wall Street lobbyists. And we need to learn from that and say, okay, fine, we've got to fix the corrupted system first, and then we can get on to doing all the incredibly important things that the next president's got to do.
Well, arguably, there's a pattern in our history of citizens' insurgencies to deal with issues. Like, for example, the Vietnam War that became incredibly unpopular, a vast anti-war movement burgeoned, and that the minute that Nixon made a deal, it sort of disappeared.
Yes, and that's what we need now, a citizens' movement. And that's why I think, you know, non-politicians in this movement, which I am, you know, if one thing I'm not a politician, you know, for a thousand reasons. Look at my glasses. You know, I teach at Harvard. That's the worst mix of qualities in a politician you can imagine. So I am not a politician. I'm a citizen. And I'm a citizen who is terrified about the future of our nation for my children and other children, too, because we cannot begin to address our problems. And we've got to find a way to force Congress to fix itself. And that's what this referendum is. It's a chance to create the most powerful mandate forcing reform that we've seen since Roosevelt's election in 1936. And I think we need to leverage that power to force them to do the right thing so that we can finally get a democracy that works again.
So how do people donate to your efforts to crowdfund your presidential announcement by Labor Day?
So you go to lessigforpresident.com. L-E-S-S-I-G for president.com. And if you donate, you have the option to make a contingent. Of course, it's nice if you don't, but you contingent in the sense that if we don't make the goal, we return the money. I don't want to take people's money unless we can do something with it. So it's $1 million or bust. So if we get it, then we run. If we don't, we send the money back.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lawrence Lessig.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's the director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University and the founder of Root Strikers, an activist network opposed to corruption in government. He's the author of Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, and One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic. He has an article at the Huffington Post on dumbing down the Democratic debate, and he is a possible candidate in the Democratic primary for president.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.